Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle. I'm president and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm very glad that you've joined us today. I always enjoy these, my chance to have conversations with leaders among us doing great things within the community and within their organizations. This year, I'm delighted to invite our sponsor for this podcast, Wells Fargo. This organization has a legacy of extraordinary engagement in the region, and they're investing in their priorities through their work and through their individual leaders. I'm honored they chose to support this enterprise as well, and more to come on that. My guest today is someone you certainly know by reputation, as he has served the city of St. Paul for 12 years now as Ward 3 city council person. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast council member Chris Tolbert. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. I'm honored to be invited.
My pleasure. My pleasure. You know, folks, you don't get a chance to often to talk to city council folks just informally. So this is going to be fun. And first of all, to our listeners, I'm going to give a shout out because Chris and I both are alums of St. John's and St. Ben's, which is kind of fun. Though he was there way after me, unfortunately. But I enjoy that connection, and it's been fun. It's been fun because professionally, I think we knew each other long before we realized that we both were alums from the same schools, right?
I think that's true. And yeah, there's a lot of us around.
Yeah, there are. And so you've served 12 years now as Ward 3 city council person for St. Paul. So take us back to Chris Tolbert in 2010. What was your thinking back then about public service, and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, you know, from the time I was a young kid, public service was something that was instilled in me through my family. That was, you know, that a career choice had to be public service. Mm-hmm. And I say that in a broad sense, because you can do public service in a variety of different ways. My family has a lot of teachers. My brother's a police officer. My grandpa was a teacher and then went into politics. Many of us are lawyers as well. But we all knew that we have this obligation, not just to our own family, but to the greater community. And so public service and was something that was instilled in me. And politics is something that I drank the Kool-Aid and fell in love with the politics of things too, which sometimes those go hand in hand, not always, but you know, I was always at St. John's. I was involved with the College Democrats and working on campaigns up there. And actually did a lot of my first campaigning up in the dorms at St. John's and St. Ben's. And
oh my gosh, that's
and
too
through
funny.
And through Cold Spring and all those types of things. So I got to know, and I'm from St. Paul. It was interesting. I was telling someone this the other day. I was like, going to St. John's was a cultural experience for me because I went to St. Paul Central. I mean, we didn't know Republicans. And I went to St. John's and I got to know Republicans. I got to know farmers. I got to know hunters. I mean, it's just a different lifestyle than you have in the city. And at my high school, and I played football up there. And so really got to know a different group of guys on the sideline than my coaches and my teammates at Central. And it was a great experience. But back to 2010, you know, when I ran for office in 2011, you know, I remember I was sitting in a CLE. I was a assistant Hennepin County attorney at the time. And a friend of mine I had done campaigns with sent me a message that with the article, I think I probably had a BlackBerry at the time. to date myself and to date the era. Pat Harris had announced he wasn't running again. He says, "Isn't this where you live?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "And it's where I also grew up." And he said, "You should run for it." Wow. And my first response was, "I don't know if I want to run for city council."
Right.
And then I was in a CLE, which for those who aren't lawyers, continuing legal education, we have to do a certain number every 3 years. You know, I had the whole day to think about it then because I'm sitting in this class.
Right.
And by the end of the time, I had gotten a group of us, we were going to get together and talk about it. And by Friday of that week, I decided I was going to run for the city council seat. I was 27 years old at the time. So back then that was a pretty young candidate. Now the candidates are quite a bit, there's what oftentimes people are running younger than that or that, but that's Chris Tolbert in 2011.
So you know what I heard in that, which was actually quite interesting to me. You said there's an obligation to serve, right? A mindset of, it's like one of the reasons I joined the military. There's this obligation to serve. And I've never, when I heard you say that, I realized that wasn't what I thought about when I thought about running for office, that because my filter would have been, gosh, I'm not good enough to go after that. And I think my thinking is wrong. You know, more and more when I talk to other public servants, there is this duty as opposed to, gosh, I'm not sure if I'm good enough to be in public service. No, the truth is, it's an obligation or a requirement of me, and ultimately a love for me to do that. And I really appreciate you framing it that way.
No, I think that's good. And I should say, I think it's an obligation. You don't have to be elected to do public service either. And I tell people that all the time. I would say some of the most important and influential people around the city or around, you know, we have in St. Paul and the Twin Cities, quite frankly, have some of the best corporate citizenship probably in America. And I think that's also serving. You know, when we fundraised for Dorothy Day Vision 2, it was, Doug Baker and other corporate folks who did their public service and did that. And that's an obligation. And I think that's something that we have that in St. Paul and Minnesota, we generally have, but it definitely was an obligation that my family ensured that I had to.
Wow.
And will continue to have for my life, I would say.
Well, and I really appreciate that too. And then when I'm thinking about the 10 years, you started out, you're young, and I mean, you've really developed, you have a fine mind, and the work that you've done over the years has been really impressive. So when I think about where the city was in 2012, and your ward in particular, the Ford plant had just shut down in Highland Park. And certainly much has changed with that site. And that had to have been just a rigorous process that I watched from my role over at the Port Authority. So tell us a little bit about transformative change that you've seen, that you've been most proud of over your 12 years.
Yeah. Well, the world has changed a lot since 2010. It really has. And I tell people all the time, the job that I started as a council member, the expectation of constituents and people when I was a new council member and the expectation today is different. I do think there's a higher expectation for availability, outreach. I mean, back when I first started, it was either snail mail, phone, or email. Now there's an expectation. We get an occasional snail mail in our office. Usually from some of the senior constituents, or a young constituent. But email is not even as popular, and nobody called. I mean, very few people call anymore. But people expect you to be available on Facebook. They expect you to be available on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. I partake in some of those, some I don't. But I think that expectation has changed and what we get involved in has changed. But in terms of the 12 years, obviously the transformation of an active Ford site, the last trucks rolled off the Ford site, November of 2011, the same month I was elected. The transformation that we had there from not only closing the plant down, the start of major demolition started in 2013, Ford started cleaning it up then.
Right.
And the first thing I said and my first priority with Ford was we want them to take their pollution with them. And I think that alone, and it doesn't get much press and people don't talk about it, that to me is probably one of the most important things I did for the neighborhood. And I didn't do it. There was a big team that did it, but ensuring that happened. And Ford cleaned it up and they did it with their own dollars and they cleaned it up to residential standards, which they were not legally obligated to do. They were only legally obligated to clean up to industrial standards. Granted, if they wanted to allow homes on it, they would have to do that extra remediation. But, I think that in itself, we also wanted a local developer who had a past and future here in St. Paul. And we were able to, you know, they sold it to Ryan Companies, which we were fortunate that they did. And then they also, at least at the time, and I haven't relooked across the country back then, I was much more knowledgeable on farm out and manufacturer plants. I think I studied every one, the 300 plus that had closed in the past 30 years prior to the Ford site in St. Paul. But none had been zoned residential. This was the only one that Ford had cleaned up to residential standards. And I think, quite frankly, I think the reason they did that is because, and to his credit, Governor Dayton, Mayor Coleman, Jonathan Sage Martinson, when he was PD director, and myself, we flew out and met with the head of Ford America. And the governor asked him himself. And he took an entire day to fly out to Dearborn and tell them. And they did it. Jonathan and I have talked about this. There was a time there where we didn't think they'd go to residential.
Yeah.
And they did. And they did on their own dime. And I think that in itself is a victory. Obviously, the master development agreement and the rezoning and then the master development agreement that we signed with Ryan and what you're seeing there now, obviously there's, you know, it's some of the housing development is slower than we had hoped because of rent control, but, you know, and other factors as well. But, you know, we have three new parks already opened. A fourth will open. We have people moved down to the site in August not this year, of 2022. You know, we have the Marvella so full, that senior housing, that they're building another one. We have an urgent care there. We have all those things. I mean, it's exciting to me. So one day, the other day, my son fell asleep in the car. And so I just was driving around and I drove through there and I just laughed at myself. I was like, when I first got elected, I would have had to set up a time with Mike Hogan, would have been the person who was the head. He was the head of the Ford plant, to have him drive me through the site. And now I can drive through it 24 hours a day. And it's just, you know, and some people walking through the water feature and doing all that. I mean, it's pretty exciting to have 135 or 125 acres of land that have been redeveloped. And for us to do it, I would say, in near record speed, but thoughtfully cleaned up well, and with a public transparency. I mean, people who had been involved with the Minneapolis Riverfront remind me it took 40 years to do Gold Meadow Park. And Highland Bridge was done. You know, it's not done. Obviously, there's still a lot of development to happen, but the trajectory is going.
Wow. Isn't that impressive? I mean, today's conversation is not about rent control, but I've certainly seen how that has severely retarded forward progress on that project to get to closure, right? Simply just because of the cost of the development. But it's still exciting for you to have seen the beginning of that dream there. So when you think about, you know, how hard these issues are, and, you know, folks come on different sides of any issue, what would you say would have been the most challenging vote you've had to take? So Highland Bridge was a fun one. What would you say is the most challenging one you had to deal with?
Well, as a Johnny, I think voting for the St. Thomas Athletic Field is probably.
Oh my gosh! Well, I'm with you on that one. So we're lined.
Honestly, I couldn't be more excited about St. Thomas and their transition to Division I. I don't think we fully appreciate the vibrancy and the level of athletic ability that's going to be brought to St. Paul because of this and visibility. I tell Athletic Director Esten Phil how excited I am. And I almost bought a Tommy shirt. I'm like, they're Division One school now. They're Division One.
Careful.
They are Division One and they're in St. Paul. And I think my St. Paul pride comes before any other pride.
That's awesome.
And but I do want to ask her, St. John's is still winning football. No, in terms of toughest votes, I know you sent me this question yesterday and I was thinking about it, and you know, the Highland Bridge vote wasn't tough. I mean, getting to the vote
was tough.
I mean, and I tell people that all the time. I think the council meetings are sometimes the least important part of the process. And I think council members who come in and think that it's all about the council meeting are missing the forest for the trees. Because it's the work that goes in ahead of time. It's it's getting to the right result and presenting yep. the right vote to have, and then it's easy. And there are votes up here where we have to choose one or the other, and those are the toughest ones. But a thing like the rezoning of the Ford site, like voting for the master development agreement or voting for St. Thomas or whatever those might be, the process was a lot. I mean, Mayor Clapp Smith and Jonathan Sage Martins and I, when we were rezoning it, we did 30 living room meetings. I mean, we, for 2 or 3 months, I think most nights of the week, I was in a different person in the village's living room with between 5 and 30 of their neighbors explaining the Ford site rezoning and why we wanted to rezone it and that type of stuff. That is long. Those are long conversations. That's a lot of time and energy, and it's worth it though. But the actual vote was a celebration because it was so important. And, but actually the toughest vote for me in my entire time was probably one of the first controversial neighborhood ones I had to take. And that was, it's almost laughable now, was the Jefferson Avenue bikeway, which all I was adding was Shero's, which was painting on the ground. But I was a month into my council term, and quite frankly, when I was campaigning, this was the number one thing people talked about, is a bike. It wasn't even a bike lane. It was a bike way, which is just paint. And it was very controversial in the neighborhood. And I just remember being like, no matter what I do, people I respect and care about are going to be furious with me. And that first time you have to do it, I remember I did the vote after, and Dan Bostrom, a former council member who had been on a lot longer than I had, he came over to me and put his arm around me. He goes, "I don't know if you're right or wrong, but I'm proud of you, Chris. You did the, you ripped the Band-Aid off. That was the tough one." And that's true. That first tough vote where, and then after you realize the world doesn't end, you know, people move on with their lives and the world doesn't end.
Well, you know, and I tell you what, the more I do this job, the more I appreciate a professional who's willing to have a conversation on an issue, and it's absent the energy of you're either with me or you're against me, right? Like you're both care about the city. There might be a different way to get there, or for that matter, a different outcome desired altogether, but at least you can be collegial about it. And I find that you've always been able to bring that energy to the work that you do. So you must have learned it early.
I try. Thank you. That's easy to say.
Okay. So let's talk about a challenging vote that I have been a part of, which has been the rent control vote. We've had good conversations about this, and the intended goal of rent control, what has been at least the short-term outcomes, which are wildly problematic. And how do you see rent control specifically, if you don't mind answering this question, how do you see rent control playing out over the long term? And like, what do you think? Does anything need to change to get at what it's actually intended to do?
Yeah. And well, as you know, B, I didn't support the proposal when it was put before the voters to start with. I still would agree that I don't think I understand the motivation of why people think that would be the right solution. But I think dedicated need-based assistance is a better approach than which we've been working on. Compared to kind of the blanket approach.
Right.
Because of the market we live in. If the market was different, if the way that housing was financed in America was different, you know, things, maybe that's a different conversation, but you know, we are who we are, and St. Paul is not New York City or San Francisco either, where we have that type of, you know, economic presence, in the world. But you know, I didn't support it. I was the one who was on the mayor's task force after it passed by voters, and worked to bring a more workable, rent control policy. You know, I think what we passed is a large improvement. I know there is criticisms of it, both people who think, you know, it opened up all these holes, and people who think, you know, the exemption isn't big enough, or this isn't big enough, or whatnot. So there is that. It is causing St. Paul problems. I mean, I think that needs to be said out loud. It has really limited the market rate development that's happening in St. Paul. Some of it I do think is people were waiting to let, they knew changes were going to happen after it passed by the voters, because the mayor basically said the week after, we need to make changes. I'm creating a task force. So if I was a business person, I would wait to see what the landscape is going to be in a year. And obviously the timing of our rent control and the increase in construction costs, the inflation costs, inflation rate, all those things happening at the same time were pretty difficult. You know, we, before rent control, I think we had a competitive advantage against Minneapolis. And I think that that's no, well, you can see it. There's a lot of development going on in Minneapolis. There's not a lot in St. Paul. I mean,
right.
I think we're now at the point where we'll probably start what we are, subsidizing market rate apartments in St. Paul, like we were right after the recession in 2010, 2011. And we had gotten away from that, which is a huge victory to the St. Paul market, I think. My personal belief, and obviously I'm leaving the council, so it will be another council that will decide, is I think, you know, I'd be fine with no rent control, but I would suggest that the best thing is to let the current ordinance play out a little bit longer, give it some time, don't tweak it. You know, small things are not a big deal, but I wouldn't make any major changes to it either way on the spec of the rent control spectrum for a while. I would let it play out. It's rent control is going to be in place in St. Paul. And I just think giving that surety so people can plan developers can plan and financiers can plan accordingly is important.
Boy, that's a rough road to hoe, isn't it? Well,
at council meetings, you know, we don't have a lot of development coming through.
Right.
Our meetings are quicker as a result of that. And, you know, some of it I think will end up coming back and happening, but it's more of a struggle than it was prior.
And the pace, slowdown of pace further extends getting to more construction outcomes. So, well, yeah. I appreciate the work that you did on behalf of that, and just the thinking around there. This is how projects happen in this country, and we're not an outlier. We aren't that special in terms of we can do things differently. So, well, we'll still be there in the fray, continue to track it, and hope that we can see more development come back. But an initiative that I have found to be really impressive that you've been really leading on, that you did choose to really own and lead on, is the Full Stack Initiative. And I don't remember what was the year. Did that start in 2017, 2018, or was it earlier than that?
It started to be informed around that time. It started as I approached Mayor Coleman about us approaching the innovative economy. And I started, I started with the tech economy. And then the mayor put together the mayor's, we didn't name ourselves, but it was basically the mayor's tech cabinet. I convinced him to start a task force, and we got a consultant to run it, and we time limited it because I didn't want an ongoing thing. I said, we got to come back. We got to come out with action. And he was all for that, because we've sat on enough endless committees in our lives. And in the first meeting, you know, I think Scott Burns rightly said, he said, you know, we keep saying tech. And he goes, I don't care if you create a new app or if you create a more efficient vacuum cleaner, it's innovation. It's not, the tech is a part of it, but it's innovating new things, and it can be improving something that's been here forever or creating something new. And so we changed our name to the Innovation Cabinet, and the Innovation Cabinet came back with recommendations that created Full Stack. We created that name with the Goth Public was our marketing firm and helping us do it. And Full Stack, at first I was like, what is this thing? And Full Stack is, in the tech world, if you're a full stack developer, you can do anything. You can code, you can build, you can architect, you can do all those things. And that, so in the tech world, it has a meaning. I didn't know what that meaning was, because I'm a lawyer, not a tech. but I've learned. And we created that. And the first goals were to create 250,000 square feet of modern innovative office space, to get 50 tech events in St. Paul, and to and to promote St. Paul as a tech, as an innovative community. And part of that was, we weren't, I started going to some of the tech events, Mini Demo, Ministar, and people weren't being shown locations in St. Paul for businesses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when we work was over at the Drake Building.
Yep.
And they went to Minneapolis. And I remember I showed up at some event that the guy was speaking at. And after, I was like, can we convince you to come back to St. Paul? And he's like, who is this guy? Some building in Minneapolis. And we talked about it, and he told me why he was going to Minneapolis. And then we started talking to real estate folks, and we realized they were showing Minneapolis when new tech companies were looking. They were showing Minneapolis, they were showing Oakdale, they were showing Bloomington, and they weren't showing St. Paul. And we said, we got a cool place for people to be. We have Lower Town, we have this thing. And we realized Scott and I tried to get a couple other companies to come here, and we didn't have a pitch. And so that was what the reason we created Full Stack, and quite frankly, the Chambers, you guys were great partners in this throughout our time and continue to be. You know, we realized we needed to get a pitch. We realized we needed to start having events here, mm-hmm. to remind people that St. Paul, the downtown St. Paul, isn't the St. Paul from when I was growing up with tumbleweeds. Like, it's a fun place to be. Lower Town's cool. And also just to promote it. And that's what, you know, that we hit all of our goals that first year within 6 months. The Osborne Building knocked off the 250,000 square feet. We had 50 events here, and we started marketing. And I think we continue to evolve, especially after the pandemic, but I think it continues to be an important economic development engine for St. Paul, or initiative, I should say.
I just think it's so great when you look at what's happened as a result of beginning there, the Osborne 370 kind of concept at the old Ecolab building has become just, what an example. I mean, seriously, you must be so proud. That building is almost full of innovative, entrepreneurial, thought-leading companies. And it was, you know, it's owned by local investors. These are companies who are invested in this region, and you get to be part of that. And kind of use it as a springboard for more development, because, you know, this groundswell starts building up and they're having great success.
Yeah. Well, and I won't take much credit for that, because I think the investors obviously put the money forward and had the vision for it. And Doug Baker, to his credit, sold it to keep it in the office space, right, rather than, because I know that I believe they had a better offer for housing. And he said, we need to keep our office sector, which thank to him. But, you know, Scott and I have talked about this since, and he goes, you pushed a snowball. You know what I mean? By being deliberate about coming to St. Paul. And I think that's really what it was, is being deliberate, and helping foster that innovative company that was happening here. I think that's the other thing. The more I go around, I'd find out these companies are here. We just didn't know about it.
Right.
Like, I went over to Primordial Soup, and they're like, yeah, we're doing this 3D printing for, this is like specific for doctors who are doing this specific surgery, and we're creating the tools for them. I'm like, wait, in the Allen Building, you're doing this?
Yeah,
like,
right.
You know what I mean? Or, you know, you go to some of these, and, you know, Lab 651, they're like, yeah, when companies can't figure out how to fix manufacturing problems, they send it to us because we're more creative. I'm like, we're doing this for Polaris. We're doing this one for here. I'm like, what? This is crazy. I had no idea. You know, yeah. Mintronics. I mean, the fact that we have we have Ecolab, which is such an international company, but there's a lot here, big and small, that are doing groundbreaking stuff that, you know, as the mayor likes to say, we just don't promote it because we're too humble.
Right. Yeah. You know, and on that note of promoting, I'm going to ask you another question. This is a bit of a setup question, because I want to hear what you have to say and share it with our listeners. So, 100 of my closest friends just went on the inner city leadership visit trip to Philadelphia. And one of the the intent is to share learning between regions. And so one of the things we wanted to learn about was their initiative, their coalition, really, to address gun violence. Really fascinating work and quite urgent work underway. And St. Paul's working on something similar to that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, St. Paul's got a lot going on right now. And I think some of it is known and some of it isn't. You know, back in when we had the spike in crime during the pandemic, especially the new phenomenon of carjackings, you know, 2021 was the worst year, at least off my memory, for carjackings. And that's when we actually started keeping track of this new phenomenon. You know, Chief Axel used to say, I said, how many do we have in 2018? He says, we don't know, because it would either have been car theft, armed assault, you know, armed robbery, or aggravated, you know, something like they put in different categories. Then they realized it was these different things. And those were scary things. Those were, because they were random. You know, one philosophy, and I borrowed this from R.T. Ryback, but, you know, I think every person who lives, works, or visits St. Paul, if you're a law-abiding citizen, you should feel safe and you should be safe in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. That should be the standard thing. Like, if you're involved with that illicit activity, that's a different question, you know, mm-hmm. but if you're a law-abiding citizen, you shouldn't be scared that you're going to be a victim of crime. I think that carjacking changed that perspective. There was a lot of, you know, political media going on with the presidential race and other things that was happening simultaneously, that I think people were promoting things out of perspective and promotion. But the carjackings were scary. And I started hearing a lot from my constituents, as well as my colleagues were. And, you know, we'd call, you know, the police department, you know, might say, well, the county attorney's not doing this. The county attorney's office would say this, the sheriff's office would say this, everyone seemed to be siloed. So, County Attorney Choi, Mayor Carter, Chief Axtell, Council President Brenmo, and myself, and others, including the sheriff's office, we created the Public Safety Leadership Group in mid-2021. And that group was an informal group. We started the meetings weekly. Mm-hmm. Basically, we called it like almost like a shoot review, like, let's see the weekly stats for this past week. What's happening? What needs to happen? We started incorporating, you know, social services, Ramsey County, all those types of things into it. And basically try to get everybody on the same page. And it broke down some barriers right away. I remember one meeting, they were having issues because they couldn't bring it was a juvenile, you know, someone who had been caught for a crime, juvenile female, and they couldn't get her into a program. One text within the meeting, Chief Axel sent one text and resolved the problem. Oh, you know what I mean? Like little right. things like that, that could have been, as you know, I mean, anyone who's in a bureaucracy, private or public, knows that endless emails and three different meetings, sometimes just getting all the people together and having one person send a text results in the thing. And it resolved. And we're like, this is what the purpose of this is. Anyways, as a result of that, and simultaneously, the mayor created the Office of Neighborhood Safety. John Choi and the Sheriff's Department got a grant, thanks to Congresswoman McCollum and the federal government, to specifically focus on carjackings, prosecution and arrest and prosecution. And then we also got money to do some GVI work, which is gun violent intervention work.
Right.
And as a result, we're able to, and now Brooke Blakey in the Office of Neighborhood Safety, as a result, and John Choi's office with the sheriff's office and all these partnerships, help identify not only high, as Chief Henry says, you know, the person that's most likely the highest level to be a perpetrator is also most likely to be the victim as well.
Right.
And so when we get the intelligence that these high profile actors are out there, they focus on them, and they don't just focus on them. They focus on their family.
Yeah.
I remember one example, Chief Axel was, I think he was presenting on it, a group of 10 individuals who were really causing a lot of havoc. And what they found was when one of them was in juvenile, the friends weren't doing anything. But when he got out of juvenile, they were all doing bad stuff. and so it's like, how do you wrap that around? Or if a shooting happened or a crime happened, we need to get to the siblings too, because the siblings feel, and I know this as someone who has a brother, you know, when your brother when my brother got picked on in school, I had an obligation, right? Like, right. And that happens. I didn't have guns, and neither did my brother, but you know, that happens. And a lot of people have guns now.
Yeah.
And so I think those, obviously there's a lot of work to do, but if you look at, you know, the juxtapose of our carjacking numbers compared to other communities, you know, we've seen a major difference. Yeah. I will say there are some things out there that, you know, I would say no amount of law enforcement, no amount of intervention unless the underlying problems are addressed will help. And I would say, one, there's too many guns out there. There's more guns being taken off the streets every day. I mean, if I was a police officer, I would assume every person I interact with has a gun. Mm-hmm. And that's because just the massive gun sales in America, legal and illegal.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to be able to change in America because of the gun laws. And number two, and I don't think we talk about this enough, but the fentanyl opiate addiction.
Oh my gosh.
And
yes,
I don't think, and I'm going to say this on here. I don't know how many people will hear, but, the underlying homelessness issue, mm-hmm. the underlying crime issue, mm-hmm. if you look at most of those, there is some opiate, fentanyl, heroin yep. level to that.
Yeah.
And no matter how many beds we offer a homeless person, if they're on those drugs, they're not going to take the bed.
Right.
And what
right.
are we supposed to do as a society? I mean, we don't have a right to just hold somebody for not committing a crime.
Right.
And I think the underlying some of the recent carjackings, or even like there was one on Grand Avenue, they ran into, I think, a Topper's over on Grand. They stole a car midday, crashed into it. The person was high on fentanyl and had it all in their pockets. I mean, wow. We need to get a hold of that. And I'm glad Sheriff Witt in Hennepin County brought that up in her last, I think 2 weeks ago. She said, folks, we're focusing on all these other things, and they need to be focused on gun violence and those things. Yep. The number one yep. killer in Hennepin County right now is fentanyl. New York Times had it. Number one killer in America. It's not even close. Above car accidents, above suicides, above gun violence, all those almost combined is fentanyl, opiate fentanyl. Our firefighters are administering Narcan every shift to people who are overdosing on this stuff. And I think we need to talk about that more than to get a hold on some of this stuff.
Well, I have just,
sorry.
This is stuff that matters to understand your thinking, which takes me to, you know, this next question. Really, I'll just have two more for you because I know I'm taking up a lot of your time, but as you've done all this work and you're learning, you know, about development and you're wrestling through real people issues around crime, how has your thinking changed in these last 12 years?
On all issues?
Just in general, how have you found yourself evolving? Maybe looking back at that 2010, Chris, and go, I've really evolved in this area. That's maybe would be interesting.
You know, and I think about this as I reminisce about my 12 years on the council a lot. You know, I think both the pandemic, and then also now I'm a parent. You know, when I was 28 year old single guy, now I have two kids married and have a dog and all that stuff. And, right. and they're in the public, you know, one's in public school, one's in daycare. You know, I look at things differently from a parental perspective, I would say. You know, one of the things I've always said is, you know, I think the two most important things for a city, of why people live in a city or potentially leave a city, is number one, the access to quality education, public schools. You know, St. Paul has a long history of private schools, but the underlying thing is we need to have strong public schools. And number two, safety. You know, obviously there's other factors, costs, you know, property tax costs, as well as, you know, how much house you can get and those types of things. But I think those two are the most important. But I think some of the values of, you know, I always valued parks, but after the pandemic, and I think people's habits have changed too. I think our parks are more full than they've ever been. And they are great economic development engines. I was at, on Sunday morning, I walked my son up to Maddox Park, which is a little pocket park in Matt Groveland. There was 100, I'm not exaggerating, over 100 people there. on a Sunday, on a Sunday morning, a little teeny park. You know, that's a lot of value to the city and to the neighborhood. Yeah. Granted, no one's spending money there, but it's an important part. So I think I've changed as a person, like where I am in my life, but you know, we all have different chapters in our life. But you know, I think the most important thing, and I tell people this all the time, is there's very few issues in life and in politics and in public life that are black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Most are full of nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Most take a lot of research. I always try and, you know, with the information I have at the time, you know, regardless of the politics of it, try and do what I think is best at the time. And, you know, sometimes I've been wrong and sometimes I've been right.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get more information and you realize you got to change course. Mm-hmm. And I think any leader has that probably approach. But, you know, I think I've evolved as a leader because, you know, like that first vote, I tell you, was the toughest.
Yeah.
When I realized no matter what I do, people are going to be upset with me. And once you kind of get over that, and I say, the most important thing is I want to be able to sleep at night. Right. And if I do a vote strictly for political reasons, that wouldn't allow me to sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not oblivious to politics, I will tell you that. But I do think you have to do what's right. Sometimes there's easy right and wrongs, you know. And but most of the time it's not. It's it's a nuance. So
well, looking at the clock here, I have more questions for you, but we've run out of time. So I just want to say thank you. One quick answer. What's on your agenda for January of 2024?
Not getting asked about the most recent variants that is being requested. No, I'm kidding.
No, that's awesome.
I'm still a practicing lawyer. So I have that option. We'll see what happens otherwise. As I said, public service is a calling. I like being involved in the community. I like doing different things. I'm still pretty young. People keep saying you're retiring. I'm like, I'm only 40.
Right.
I still got some time ahead of me.
Yeah.
I do look forward to, you know, spending a lot of time with my kids and being a T-ball coach and soccer coach and doing those coach. Hockey is hopefully. And doing that, but it's been a great time being on the council. It's been a great honor. I will say I really appreciated the partnership. The chamber and the initiatives I've worked on, you guys have been just key partners, you know, Right Track. We started in 2013 in partnership with the chamber.
Yeah, yeah.
And we couldn't have grown it and legitimized it without the chamber's support throughout. Full Stack, you guys right away were a part of that. And we couldn't have grown and continue to have. I mean, you're still a co-chair with me. You'll be a co-chair and I'll be off. You know, those things have been important. And even when we disagreed on issues, mm-hmm. you know, we've always had that open door and been able to talk about it. And I just appreciate the chamber and the members. And as I said earlier, to all your members who are just, I think we have one of the best corporate citizenship environments in the country. And I appreciate your members for being involved in our community and caring about it.
Well, we back at you. We appreciate you too, more than you probably know. So thank you for the service. Congratulations on the next season ahead of you. And thanks to all of the listeners for joining us for Bee's Table Talk and Wells Fargo, our sponsor. We have more conversations in the weeks ahead, speaking to more business leaders, public servants here in the greater MSP region. Have yourselves a great day, and we will see you in the trenches.